This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and please stay with me for this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests that are designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the full-service law firm of Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area and clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about OF&P, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com. And I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org. It features topics of interest in tax, estate planning, and business planning, audio, video, and written articles that might help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. And lastly, please visit my articles in the Washington Business Journal once a month where I write a column entitled Blueprint for Wealth, and it's on the same topics, tax, estate planning, and business planning. Hopefully, you'll get some knowledge out of those articles. And if you have any questions, give us a call at 703-218-2100. Today, we're going to be talking about the president's new Jobs Act, what he proposes to do to spur the economy try to get the economy back on track in terms of increasing or creating jobs and what it's going to cost in that regard. First of all, President Obama is suggesting that there be tax cuts to help America's small businesses hire and grow. Now, this is nothing new. It's basically a continuation of some of the incentives that the president had offered up over the last couple of years. Number one, he proposes cutting the payroll tax in half for the first $5 million of wages per employer. That means that the FICA tax, the Social Security tax, would drop from 6.2% down to 3.1%. And again, it would be capped at $5 million, but essentially it would affect over 98% of all employers in the United States. Now, that's a significant benefit because that allows the employers not to have to pay Social Security up to the maximum cap amount on the employees. What a benefit. But what's going to happen to the Social Security Trust Fund as a result of the depletion of funds? That's my question, not the president's. Next incentive that he's offering is eliminating temporarily employer payroll taxes on wages for new workers or for giving raises for existing workers. Now, a lot of employers have frozen the pay of employees because of the downturn in the economy. This would allow for a tax holiday on the full 6.2 payroll tax that companies have to pay for any growth in payroll up to $50 million above the prior year, whether it's driven by new hires or increased wages or both. So this is a job creation measure that the Congressional Budget Office has called probably the most effective of all the tax cuts in supporting employment and increasing hiring in the economy. The last tax incentive that the president is offering is one that's currently in effect in 2011, and that is very generous expensing provisions where you can write off computers, software, furniture, fixtures and equipment, and even leasehold improvements. The provision expires at the end of 2011 and goes back to a much less generous provision. He would extend it for the 2012 tax year. The president is also proposing to help entrepreneurs and small businesses gain access to capital. It includes administrative, regulatory, and legislative measures, including those developed and recommended by the president's Job Council, to help small firms get started and expand. The president is going to announce a plan to accelerate government payments to small contractors so that they get paid faster. So if there's a government contractor who's performing services for the federal government, they'll get paid in as fast as 30 days as opposed to the typical 90 days or longer that the government is able to pay. The second major part of the president's proposal is to put workers back on the job while rebuilding and modernizing America. And one of those provisions is a tax credit, providing special benefits to those who hire unemployed veterans. The employer can get a tax credit of up to $5,600 for hiring unemployed veterans who've been looking for a job for more than 6 months. There's also a Wounded Warriors tax credit of up to $9,600 for unemployed service-disabled veterans. It also provides provisions for preventing layoffs of teachers. In fact, they're proposing to invest $35 billion that will lead to retaining over 280,000 teachers that otherwise would be laid off under state government budget cuts. Some of the funds that would be raised in the proposal would be used to modernize our public schools. Over 35,000 schools would be modernized. Science labs, internet-ready classrooms, renovated facilities would be modernized. Up to $25 billion of investment in school infrastructure will be set aside for that. Also, the president has proposed setting aside $50 billion in immediate investments for highways, transit, rail and aviation, helping to modernize an infrastructure that now gets a grade of D from the American Society of Civil Engineers, helping rebuild our infrastructure. He also proposes setting aside $10 billion for establishing a national infrastructure bank and $15 billion for project rebuild that would put people back to work rehabilitating homes, businesses, and communities in the local jurisdictions. His proposal also includes pathways back to work for Americans that are looking for jobs. There would be reform for unemployment insurance so that people could still receive unemployment insurance as long as they're volunteering or entering into training programs. So it's known as the Bridge to Work program. States also would be able to use the unemployment insurance to encourage older, long-term unemployed Americans to return to work in new industries or occupations. In other words, trying to push back the retirement age a little bit. There would be money that would be set aside, also in terms of payroll tax cuts, which I've already alluded to. And he proposes paying for this $447 billion as follows. Let me tell you that it's not, you know, the pain is not without, or the pleasure is not without pain. We have to be able to pay for these tax, for these provisions by, he proposes, increasing taxes. He proposes limiting itemized deductions for families with taxable incomes of $250,000 or more, and ending tax breaks for oil and gas companies and corporate jet owners. So if you're making more than $250,000 in taxable income, your itemized deductions would be limited to a tax benefit of no more than 28%, even though the tax rates might be as high as 35%. So you're losing essentially 7% of your itemized deductions, or the benefit of 7% of your itemized deductions. That would apply to married and filing joint taxpayers. For individuals, it would be for anyone with taxable income over $200,000. On the oil and gas side, they're proposing to disallow intangible drilling costs. It's been in the Internal Revenue Code since the 1980 Tax Act, and it is a significant benefit to the oil and gas industry. But compared to the disallowance of the deduction for itemized deductions for so-called wealthy taxpayers, it's relatively small. The itemized deduction disallowance provision is going to result in tax revenue increases to the federal government of approximately $408 billion. So out of the $447 billion, you can see that individuals who are supposedly high net worth will be hit with this tax increase. The intangible drilling cost provision is a much smaller provision. Another hidden surprise in the president's proposal, but it's been proposed over legislation over the last 7 or 8 years, is the disabling or preventing investment fund managers, venture capitalists, and others from claiming capital gains treatment, long-term capital gains treatment, on the so-called carried interests they have in their investment funds. Normally, when somebody sets up a venture capital fund or a private equity fund or a hedge fund or an investment fund, the person who sets it up gets a management fee, a small management fee up front for each year that the fund is in existence, and may participate in profits only after the investors get their preferred returns out of the deal. After the investors get their preferred returns out of the deal, they may take as high as 20% of the residual profits of the entity. That 20% is known as a carried interest. In the past, tax practitioners have treated that carried interest as being subject to long-term capital gains. The highest rate on those types of on that type of income right now is 15% for federal tax purposes. The president proposes subjecting the carried interest to ordinary income tax rates. So needless to say, this has created a significant furor on Wall Street. Now, the president's proposals are not a slam dunk. In fact, many have said that his proposals are dead on arrival, that the whole piece of legislation will not pass, mainly because of the tax increases on the wealthy. He's going to also submit a deficit reduction proposal that would reduce the deficit over $2 trillion over 10 years, beginning on September the 19th, and that will be considered by the so-called super committee that is going to deal with how to reduce the deficit. I imagine in that $2 trillion of deficit reduction, there will be significant additional tax increases, which we will report to you as soon as we find out exactly what they're proposing. In any event, the idea of tax increases to pay for jobs, infrastructure building is a controversial item, to say the least. If you have any questions about these tax provisions, give us a call at 703-218-2100 or visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth. And by the way, don't forget to subscribe to my blog where you can get the latest and greatest information on tax, estate planning, and business planning at www.blueprintforwealth.org.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in just a few moments.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
What does an employer have to do before hiring an employee? Besides federal and state laws that prohibit discrimination in the workplace and mandate standards for worker safety, employers have to fulfill several basic requirements before employing workers. They must determine if the worker is an employee or an independent contractor. Issues such as tax withholding from employee paychecks and liability may be implicated by this decision. They should also use federal and state guidelines to determine whether workers are in fact employees. Employers should obtain federal and state employer ID numbers, which are used for tax purposes. Depending on the state, employers may also be required to participate in a workers' compensation insurance pool and obtain an unemployment and compensation identification number. Some states may have additional requirements for employers, so employers may want to consult with an experienced employment law attorney to ensure compliance with federal and state law.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my partner, John Dedon, who's an often appearing co-host on the show. John, welcome.
Thanks, Wayne. Great to be here.
John is a trusts and estates guru for all of you out there. If you need to get in touch with somebody who really knows trusts and estates, give John a call at 703-218-2131. 2131. And with us today is our special guest, Brian Kennedy, who's Vice President Business Development at Wilson Bennett Capital Management. But you're also at Cardinal Bank, aren't you?
At Cardinal Bank with their trust department as well. I work with clients both with Wilson Bennett and Cardinals Trust.
So you're wearing multiple hats.
Absolutely.
Well, welcome to the show. And John, let me turn it over to you so you can lead us through this interesting interview with Brian.
Thanks, Wayne. That's quite a buildup. I hope we can live up to it.
I'm already going out to get my cup of coffee. Okay, so
Brian, Wayne mentioned your position. Why don't you tell us generally about what you do with Cardinal?
Sure. I work with the wealth management group at Cardinal. We have a $3 billion wealth management group there. Cardinal's a $2 billion bank, serving both institutions and individuals, and work with both groups with investment management needs, trust needs, and other type of wealth planning needs as well.
And how long have you been there?
I've been there just a little over 5 years. My fifth year anniversary was this June, as a matter of fact.
And I know you have a passion both for hockey and fishing, but how did you get into the banking world?
I got into the banking world actually out of the hotel business. I had gotten into systems work, and then the old Riggs National Bank downtown was converting their trust accounting system and was hired on to be part of that conversion team. So I was fortunate in that I learned the trust business from the back of the house out from the very beginning.
Well, I want to get into the trust business a bit, but let's come back to your earlier comments about Cardinal. I know we have a lot of mutual clients, and Cardinal's really a large bank in this area.
Cardinal, I'd say, is a leading bank in this area. When you think about it, we've been here now for 12-plus years, have a fabulous reputation in the small and medium-sized business community, a great mortgage company, deposits, customized loans for our clients. But I think one of the best-kept secrets, and we don't want it to be a secret anymore, you know, is our powerful and sophisticated wealth management group.
So in that group, you consider your competition the Wells Fargo's and SunTrust's of the world?
The Wells Fargo's and SunTrust's. You also in this area see some very competent, smaller registered investment advisors. And other firms that we've gone up against are the likes of Bernstein and J.P. Morgan as well.
And how do you distinguish yourselves from those other institutions?
Yeah, a couple things. I think, one, we have a very Main Street perspective on things. We don't have a New York presence. You know, we're headquartered here in McLean, Virginia. We have offices in D.C. and Maryland. This is our home. This is where we're focused. I think we have a very common sense approach, not just to our lending, but also to our investing. And, you know, we're your next door neighbor. You know, I may coach your son or daughter in ice hockey. One of my other colleagues may be teaching one of your sons or daughters at a junior achievement program.
Well, I know one of your executives happens to be a neighbor of mine, so I can speak firsthand to that, as well as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the clients that we do share. It seems you have a lot of closely held business clients and a lot of folks who have real estate and a lot of wealth that's centered in the D.C. metropolitan area.
Yeah, two of the areas where we really specialize in is in serving the real estate community and also serving the government contractor community, which, as I think we all know, have been two of the big wealth generators that we've had here in D.C. for some time.
Well, I know I have a lot of confidence in working with you just from my experience. I also know that you offer continuing education for lawyers with one of the things that that you focus on. So you have quite an expertise. I'm speaking of particularly the role of corporate fiduciaries. So why don't we talk a bit about that?
Sure. You know, I think it's important, especially in this day and age where people's confidence about some measures of our financial system have been, you know, perhaps a little rocked over the last couple of years, to really emphasize how important a fiduciary is. And, you know, in its simplest essence, a fiduciary is a person or a business who is bound to do the best thing for the client or the beneficiary of a trust. And when you think about that in its simplest essence, that's a very, very serious responsibility.
Well, I know in the estate planning world where I set up trusts for clients, they are often considering if it's a mom and dad upon their death, will they have a sibling who serves as a trustee? If it's adult child, will the child be a trustee? Or will they have a institution such as a bank who'll be the trustee? What are some of the considerations they should look at as they distinguish between those different types?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes back to impartiality. It also comes back to expertise. There's a lot to running a trust, whether it's from the investment, the legal, or the tax standpoint, that a person that does not do this every day would really end up finding themselves doing an awful lot of heavy lifting, and I think really another full-time job. Just to give you one small example from a tax perspective, you know, an individual filing single it needs to be somewhere north of $350,000 a year in annual income to hit the top marginal tax rate. To be an irrevocable trust and have retained income in the trust, you hit that top marginal rate at just over $11,000. Now, you think about a family member, they might think they're doing a wonderful thing for the family to retain the income in the trust and try to make that trust get larger for future generations. That may not be the best thing tax-wise to do for that given family. That's just one small example of how technical and how specialized managing a trust can be.
Well, I know when people ask my opinion, I always emphasize there is a lot of responsibility that goes with serving as a trustee. And certainly if they name a family member, they're going to need an attorney or a CPA or somebody to help them with that. And if they name the bank, they have the bank right from the start who's able to take over those obligations. And that doesn't even get into one thing you alluded to, which is kind of the impartiality issue and whether there's even appropriate family members to serve in that role.
And that could be a challenge. You know, as we know, in these days of mixed families and different family dynamics, that type of impartiality can sometimes be, I think, a bit harder to find than it might have been in a more 50s or 60s oriented type nuclear family. Absolutely.
Because most trusts will have what they call ascertainable standards, which are meant to be somewhat objective, but there's always some subjectivity that goes into how the trust is construed. And certainly having a bank like Cardinal that knows how the standards are determined is helpful for guidance.
John, what are those standards? Why don't you define, what is an ascertainable standard in terms of how we, when we draft a trust, what does that mean? Or Brian, maybe you can fill us in on that.
Well, the magic words are health, maintenance, support, and education. And I tell people that you can't scientifically define what those mean because they can mean different things for different families and different net worth. But the advantage of having a Cardinal, for example, as the trustee, they've seen this before and they know how to apply those standards to particular situations.
And on top of that, there are other standards. You know, discretionary trusts have been set up these days with an eye towards asset protection for families. And you know, if you go outside of the bounds of distribution standards and those types of trusts, you know, the assets that you set this trust up to protect, they may become subject to creditors.
So what do you mean by discretionary trust, Brian? Tell us what that typically refers to.
Yeah, a discretionary trust is one in which there is not a necessarily a mandatory distribution of income or principal to the beneficiaries. You typically want to have an independent third-party trustee, or at least one of the co-trustees, an independent third-party trustee, who's making those distribution decisions so that the assets cannot be considered either part of the current estate of the beneficiary or at their death, part of their estate that could potentially be taxed.
And it also gives asset protection, doesn't it, John?
And asset protection is a significant issue that I see where a lot of people set up trusts motivated for tax purposes, but asset protection is an equal concern because they want to make sure the assets that pass down the generations don't end up with a former daughter-in-law or son-in-law or creditors for that matter.
Exactly.
And, another thing I see, Brian, these days, with the ability to gift $5 million and setting up trusts that are so-called dynasty trusts that are designed to go on for future generations, having that institutional trustee is very important, not just to determine how they're construed, but also for the permanence of having a trustee that will be there, if not Cardinal, a successor, but at least an institution that you've named.
Oh, absolutely. And when you take a look at the power of the numbers that come into play in a dynasty trust in terms of what you eventually have in terms of tax savings and assets that get built up over the generations for a family, to have an institution that you know that's going to be able to span those generations and be there to serve each generation, very, very powerful.
And I want to get into this directed trustee notion, but one last thought on the dynasty trust. I know that President Obama and the Treasury want to limit dynasty trust to 90 years instead of allowing that to go on in perpetuity. So for those who have the kind of assets that make it worthwhile, it's something they should be acting on before 2012. As we talk about the trustee role, sometimes people want to have family involved, but they recognize the burdens are such that they want an institution involved as well. And that gets us to the directed trustee notion.
Well, first let me comment in terms of our views on the family involvement and also the openness of a relationship in a trust. And we do think that one of the best structures to have is a family co-trustee along with an institutional or professional co-trustee. You really get the best of both worlds in that situation.
Why is that?
It, on the one hand, what we've talked about already in terms of the longevity, the impartiality, the actual professional knowledge that the institutional trustee has. But when you have a personal trustee who really is in touch with what the needs of the family are and can interpret some of those fine lines that we all see in life every day, you know, the shades of gray that,
right.
You know, we never get the black and white that we often would like to have. I think it's a big help to take that approach.
They know the kids, they know the grandkids, they know the family. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to have a, within that, you know, we think that any type of relationship is one where you want to make sure that there's an ability to end that relationship if it's not productive. So whether it's terms in the trust that allow the beneficiaries to choose a substitute trustee or a trust protector who's in there, you know, people sometimes ask me, well, don't you not want to see that as a corporate trustee? Absolutely not. You know, because we think a relationship that's gone into where both parties know that if needs be, it can be ended amicably, that is a relationship that starts off on a much better foot.
So you get the best of both worlds in that the person who sets up the trust knows there's an institutional trustee, but there's flexibility built in so that if that institution no longer is serving its purpose, it can be removed, and as long as we provide for another one to step in.
100%. And to, you know, follow on your question in terms of the directed trustee and a directed trust role, that's sort of a evolution, if you will, of the specialization of trusts. And you mentioned the talk that I give for legal credit. You know, one of the metaphors I use in that talk is the development of specialization in baseball pitching. You know, back in before the 1900s, most teams only had one pitcher. They would pitch, you know, 70. The record for complete games in a season is a Cincinnati Reds pitcher with 75. And as a matter of fact, the top 100 pitchers of most complete games in a season all pitched their games before 1900.
And his arm is about 6 feet long. He's not alive anymore.
But what we see now is, you know, starters who are judged by a quality start. And I'm a hockey guy. Baseball people might be able to better define what a quality start is. We have middle inning relievers, setup men, closers. You know, it's become a very similar world in the trustee world, where now sometimes you have your administrative role done by a directed trustee. And then the trust document itself, if you're in a jurisdiction that allows this, and the District of Columbia and Virginia are two of those jurisdictions under the Uniform Trust Code, the trust can name an other investment advisor, which sometimes will come up with for a closely held business that a family wants to keep, private equity situations, or even perhaps a longtime family investment advisor that the family still wants to be able to use.
So the concept is that the trustee, such as Cardinal, is able to manage the liquid assets, but the closely held business interest or the real estate stays with the other trustee.
Absolutely. Total customization for the family, making sure that the family is taken care of in the way they want it to. And if I could here, my compliance officers will be happy if I mention that I'm a financial advisor in my role as well with our Cardinal Wealth Services area, brokerage through Raymond James. And they just want us to make sure to know that securities and investment management are not FDIC insured.
Brian, if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
They do that either on my direct number, please call me, 703-584-6006, or Brian with an I, .Kennedy, like the former president, at cardinalbank.com.
Brian, it's been a pleasure having you as a guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
And John, great job again. Thanks for being here to lead us through the charge.
Thanks, Wayne.
Everybody, listen to Blueprint for Wealth next week for another special topic and special guest. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 with your Blueprint for Wealth, right here on 1500 AM Federal News Radio.